David Rossberg from Friedberg Mercantile Group in Niagara Capital. I'm here with Al Friedberg. Morning, Al. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. I apologize for the delay. We've had some technical problems this morning. Today is October 31st. We are going to follow the usual format. That's to say that we invite people to email us our questions. Email us your questions. You can email questions to erott, E-R-O-T-T, at niagaracapital.ca. We already have quite a few questions, not surprising, given really the dramatic events that have occurred in the past month in particular. But we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. We try and keep the call to about 45 minutes. We don't want to delay your day too much. And with having said as much, we'll get right into it. Al, in your quarterly report published a week or so ago, you spoke in very dramatic language about the crisis in Europe and the potential global effects of that crisis. You wrote the report prior to last Wednesday's meeting, and in response to that, the market took on a very sanguine aspect. And so, at least since that day, the market looked as though or was telling or trying to announce that the crisis had reached or had passed the crisis point, so to speak. What's your view now?
I don't think that anything has really changed. In fact, I believe that things have become worse now. And let me explain something. First of all, let me explain a little bit the action, the market action. For close to a month, the market has been expecting and has been led to believe that there will be a solution, and there were a lot of favorable comments on the part of EU officials and a lot of promises of, let's call it bazooka-type approaches, $1 trillion, $2 trillion, and so on. The market was generally, let me put this, the market was generally skeptical and probably with pretty good reason that that they would put together anything. But at any rate, they did put together something, and I, by the way, I'm saying this because I think that that can explain a great deal of the actions subsequent to the release of the agreement, which was a huge, huge move up in the market. I think the market was skeptical that they could put it together, and it was pretty remarkable that they were able finally to put something together. And then, of course, and during this time, there's a lot of shorting, a lot of maybe small retail account shorting. We've seen some numbers from banks that have told us that retail selling on the 23rd and 24th, especially on the 24th, were the highest there have been, probably the highest there have been in their own history. Again, the idea was that maybe they can't make it, that they can't put it together. So when they did announce the agreement, I believe that it led to a huge amount of short covering and a sort of a sigh of relief. And so then you have this paradox of market, well-informed market observers thinking that this is, they're skeptical basically of what went on and of the package. And at the same time, you had people buying shares with abandon. And I believe that that had to do with short covering. But no sooner the short covering was over, by Friday, markets had quieted down, and there was very little follow-through, almost no follow-through. And as we know this morning already, there's been a fall-off. Now, that's what the market thought, and that's what the market was generally skeptical of their ability to put through a package. The real issue is how adequate is the package? How adequate is this approach to deal with this enormous debt problem that Europe has? And in my view, it's totally inadequate, and not only totally inadequate, but it's likely to cause even more pain in the longer run. By that I mean that they have not attacked the single main or two main problems. Number one problem is that these countries, like Italy and Spain and Portugal and Greece, are no longer competitive, given the euro, given their tie to the euro. Their costs have gone up between 30% and 40%, at least in respect to Germany and Netherlands, let's say. And they cannot compete, and because they cannot compete, exports have not moved and imports have risen, and economic activity has stagnated, and as economic activity stagnates, unemployment rises, and government revenues fall, and government revenues fall no matter what. And all these austerity packages will do nothing to help them, just the opposite, will make it worse. So the focus should have been to do something about the exchange rate for these countries. And of course, being in the euro, it's very difficult because there's no exit. So they have to create some kind of an exit. So that's number one. And number two, of course, all the European banks, prodded by regulators in the last 10 or 15 years who have made the holding of sovereign debt something like impregnable, because they said you don't need any reserves for it, any capital reserve for it, and therefore have led them to accumulate enormous positions in sovereign debt, are bankrupt. The fact is that these countries will not be able to pay, and if they can't pay, not just Greece, but many of these countries will not be able to pay 100 cents on the dollar, certainly not 100 cents on the dollar. Maybe they'll be able to pay 60 cents or 50 cents or whatever. Well, at those rates, at those levels, the European banks, practically all European banks, are broke. And so there should have been something far more substantial directed at recapitalizing European banks. So if I look at a plan and I say to myself, you know, this plan doesn't make any sense. It's not dealing and it's not adequate enough. It may buy them. In the beginning, I thought it may buy them maybe 2 months. By the time Wednesday, Thursday came around, I thought that maybe it can buy them maybe 2 weeks. But now the market smells blood, and the market now smells the fact that they are incapable and are not able to think through properly what needs to be done, and don't have the political will and the political guts to do it. Now the market will turn with a vengeance. And it's not going to be pretty. And I'm afraid to say that what could be happening, or what will be happening, is something quite severe, quite a severe economic dislocation. So, I repeat my warning of the shareholder letter, which was written maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Al, in the shareholder's letter, you used the word depression. I cautioned you against what I thought might have been a bit of hyperbole, but since then, you stuck to your guns in internal communications within the firm. You've been at least as strong in your speech. When you talk about economic dislocation, can you describe or give some sense of the breadth of that? Are we talking about the demise of the euro? Is France in peril? You're talking about the destruction of European banks. What does this mean for equity securities globally? Can you be a little bit specific in your description of this dislocation?
Well, what I mean at the minimum, I believe that we will see. Let's start with the euro. I don't think that the euro is yet yet in danger of disappearing. It is probably possible, and as I suggested in my previous answer, that something has to be done about these countries that are not competitive. It's probably the right thing to do that would be for these stronger countries like Germany and Netherlands and Finland and Austria and maybe France, if they can take France along with them. France is already teetering. Take them and stay with the euro and allow the other countries to leave the euro, go back to some local currency, and say to them, take care of your problems and come back and knock on the door again in 5 years, or maybe 3 years. So the euro does not have to disappear. The euro can still stay, and the idea, at least it's fixed in their minds, political mind, that the euro is an important element in in European politics, and the idea that Europe is united. And so that does not have to disappear, but what has to happen is that some major economic adjustment has to take place as far as the currency value of these other countries. Now, along the way, I think that you will continue to have very, very deep recessions in Spain and starting in Italy and Portugal and Greece. And, of course, Ireland is having a severe recession, too. And unless it gets solved and unless they are able to, at some point, devalue and get a better value for the currency, chances are that they their unemployment will rise. I am of the opinion that that pain will be shared once they can devalue. Therefore, what will happen is that they will begin to recover, and maybe the northern countries will be slowed down a bit. But at any rate, we're talking about a long period of economic stagnation. Now, what happens to the banks? That's a serious problem, and it will have global repercussions because the banks are providers of credit, and right now they're being told that they have to redress or they have to increase their capital ratios. They're not able to raise money in this market. They certainly don't want to raise money at 50% of their book value. So what they are saying now is that they're likely to do it internally by way of deleveraging, cutting back credit to the private sector where their capital ratios are high, which is strange because, of course, what you need to do is the opposite. You need to get away from the sovereign credit where capital ratios are zero and go to those to that sector, like the private sector, which is dynamic and able to pay and survive, and where your capital ratios are higher. So it's a perverse incentive that the regulators have given them now. At any rate, by them contracting private sector credit, it will have huge repercussions, not just in Europe, but all over the world, in Latin America, in Asia. And it will have repercussions in the U.S. I mean, there is counterparty risk. The large banks in the U.S. have credit. I'm not talking about a little bank in Madison or in some place in Iowa, but the large New York City banks have exposure to European companies and European banks, and I think it will have a major impact on them. It's not going to do a lot for our economy, so chances that we're going to relapse into some kind of recession. So you have the makings of a synchronized global recession, and now you move to Asia, where both China and India are fighting a rising inflation rate, an accelerating inflation rate, and they're still applying brakes. India just raised rates the other day, for the 10th time, I think it is, and they're not able to bring inflation yet under control. So they are decelerating. So we have Asia now decelerating in the face of this situation in Europe, and the same thing is happening in Brazil. Whether they like it or not, the Brazilian Central Bank is doing the wrong thing now, of course, it's lowering rates, but the truth is inflation is a problem in Brazil, and it's slowing the economy, and it's going into reverse. So when I mean a depression, I don't mean necessarily a level of unemployment or a level of economic stagnation as much as a very, very general, very it's synchronous around the world. That means almost every economy is weak, and there's very few sectors, or almost no sectors, that can pull up the world economy from the slump they're in. So it's going to take a lot of time to work this out. It's going to take a lot of time to work this out.
Now, that's at the minimum. With I hesitate to ask you what the maximum might be. Do you want to volunteer a response to that, or should I move on to this?
No, let's move on.
Let's move on. Okay. A valid question that comes from a longtime client relates not so much to the selections in the portfolio, but how the investors' assets are protected. That's to say, how are you thinking about counterparty risk in terms of the global macro fund, in our own Niagara Legacy Fund? What issues in relation to the prime brokers that you're using are you concerned about? What is your opinion about the ISDA agreements that you have in place? There was an opinion reported by a derivatives association that Greek debt will likely trigger default clauses in credit default swap contracts. How are you going to invest in credit default swaps? Or how are you thinking about investing in credit default swaps with that kind with those kinds of issues floating about? And then there are now restrictions on shorting. The CFTC is implementing restrictions on shorting, and likewise, there's still restrictions on shorting financial stocks in Europe. How is all this being dealt with?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question, and the fact is that we're spending almost as much time thinking about the market as we're thinking about counterparty risk. I mean, this has gotten to the point where it's taken an enormous amount of energy from us and making us do things that are more expensive. It's clearly more expensive to operate in certain ways. We are conscious of it. We have tried to move as much as we can assets to safe areas, quote-unquote safe areas, or as safe as one can make them to be. The problem, of course, is that when you're dealing with derivatives, as you mentioned, or forex positions, you still have some counterparty risk, at least the differentials. You know, you still have the differentials of profit and losses at risk. And I think it's something that almost nobody can escape. You know, we're in a world where you basically can't escape that kind of risk, other than taking your money and converting it to cash and putting the cash under your mattress. So we try as much as we can to think about that and to try to do something about it. Now, it's interesting that you bring up the question of derivatives and CDS as credit default swaps. In the last few weeks, something very unusual has happened, which is Europeans have this hang-up that they don't want to trigger any of the credit default swaps because that would, in their minds, trigger a psychology of default. And so they have done everything possible to have a default occur of some sort with Greece, but not trigger the default clause or event. And they say it's voluntary. Well, the rules are that if it's voluntary, if I lent you $100 and I say, David, you know what, to my own free will, I'll only ask you to repay me $50, that's not a credit event. And so it's a voluntary event. And therefore it doesn't trigger the insurance. However, it may have been reasonable for most banks to have done that when they asked them a few weeks ago or maybe a couple months ago to take a 20% or 21% haircut. And then, you know, banks had to weigh the political gain of having to say yes against the fact that they can get fully repaid if they trigger the credit default swaps. So there was, I would think, a pretty good participation, reluctant, but pretty good participation in this voluntary program. Maybe, I don't remember what it was, but it was over 80% anyway. Now they're asking them to take a 50% voluntary cut, and now it's going to get very difficult because the banks that have protection are going to say, why should I voluntarily give in and only get 50% when I can get paid fully by triggering the default clause. So to my mind, I don't think it's possible to get around this problem. And I don't think that they can step in I do not believe that they can step in and abrogate the private contracts. I mean, that would not be possible. I think the Western world still has some respect for law and order, and I don't think that will be done yet. This is not, these are not emerging countries that we're dealing with, and there are contracts, and these contracts, and there are committees, and there are rules, and the rules will decide whether it's an event of default or not. Right now, it's in limbo. But if let's say 80% of banks and 70% of banks do not tender and do not voluntarily give in, and I can see those that certainly those that have crazy full swaps on, and then Greece doesn't pay, it's an event. It's an event of default, and those CDSs will pay. So I'm not really concerned about that. I think that they will pay. I'm more concerned about the actual counterparty risk. You know, my credit default swaps are with banks. And, you know, what if these banks can't pay? The profit that we made. So that's a little bit more complicated. I think that you can rest assured, the Lightning shows can rest assured that we're trying our best. Our money's on the line, too. And it really is a very difficult exercise. It's very, very difficult, and it's really impossible to cover all aspects. And there will be things that will happen that we won't know what can be done or what should have been done.
Have you moved all your all assets from margin to type 1 accounts?
Those that can be moved, we have. You know, those that can. As I said, there's many derivative positions that cannot be moved.
There's a in the midst of such incredible drama and uncertainty, I think many shareholders must have read the quarterly letter with a great deal of surprise, learning that you'd exited your gold positions early in the third quarter. Can you perhaps explain or elaborate why you did that and get the catalyst of what might draw you back into the market?
Yes. First of all, we did exit the market at very good levels. I would think that we must have averaged around 1850, maybe 1875 average. You know, some things were done at the low 1800, some things were done over 1900. But we exited, and the reason we exited was the following. Number one, I felt that the quality of the buying was getting poorer and poorer. The types of investors that were buying gold, the type of buying with abandon that was being done, the fact that people thought about it as being the one thing that will save them from Armageddon and that's the only thing that will work. I think it began to bother me quite a bit in the beginning of the third quarter. So from a technical position, the market was getting overbought, and I mean overbought by very poor quality buying. From a more fundamental point of view, though, the scenario that I painted just a few minutes ago when you asked me after the first question is one in which your real danger, your real risk is not inflation. In the short run. When I say the short run, maybe in 6 months to a year and a half. The real danger is credit implosion, a credit deflation, which will affect commodity prices in a big way. And my guess is that if commodity prices, and I'm not even saying if, but when commodity prices come down, and this scenario, it will affect gold significantly. Now, it's not going to take gold down at 50%, but it could take down the market to maybe 1,400 or 1,500, somewhere around there. I don't know. I don't have a level. What I want to see is I want to see how the market behaves during this credit deflation or during this credit implosion. I want to see how the market behaves, and I want to see whether it can regain its technical strength and whether it will have been able to get rid of all that excess baggage, all that overbought condition.
Okay, thank you. We'll want to talk a little bit about the Bank of Ireland and about Canadian banks. You were long Bank of Ireland and short for a while Canadian banks and had a rather bearish view of Canada. But before I ask you that, Let's turn to a more difficult question. You had a superb third quarter, one of the best that the Global Macro Fund has enjoyed since it started in 2001. In fact, I think the best. However, as many investors know, our month of October was our most disastrous month since we started. In the shareholder's letter, you spoke about a relationship between your short bets and the volatility of the securities markets, in particular the stock market. Do you feel that that perhaps you were being conservative in making those distinctions or making those determinations? There was one day, the day after the accord was reached, that's to say on Thursday of last week, we had a record loss that day that superseded even the terms that you described in the shareholder's letter. What's going on?
All right, let me start by actually asking me, I'm going to ask myself, you don't ask this question, but I'm going to ask myself a question that was asked by a shareholder directly. And I think that I can this way introduce the subject. And the question was, well, you had a great quarter and the end of the quarter was great. Why didn't you just move aside and you know, take in the profit, the great profit, and move aside? And I want to say that is really not that's not something that we ever contemplate. And the reason is, I don't want to use the metaphor of gambling, but when you go to a casino and you're doing well and you keep going, you're pressing your luck. That's what you're doing, you're pressing your luck. So when somebody says to you, well, you just made $1 million, well, why do you continue? You should walk away. The answer, the question is a rational question because, you know, you're making money in a chance operation. That's where you're making money, and chance can change tomorrow. That luck can change tomorrow. So, but we don't press. The truth is that we're not pressing our luck in this game. We're pressing our advantage. And our advantage is and has been that we saw this happening, and we saw this coming, and we believe that we see in a deeper way, in a more insightful way, what is happening. And that, and when we don't see any solution to that, we say we want to press that. So let me start by saying that we never think of getting off so long as we think we have an advantage, and we are pressing our advantage. We still are pressing our advantage despite the reaction. The second thing, of course, one can argue and say, you know, when we were up 15%, we could have done the same thing. We were up 15% and everybody else was down and it looks great, why don't we get out? And when we were up 25%, it was the same, and 35% and 45% and so on. So that argument can be made at any time. Really, and only in retrospect one can say, well, you should have done it earlier. You know. So, having said that, let me say this, that we went up, I just did some numbers the other day, and our net asset value went up 76% actually from the early February lows. To the end of September, 76%. Now, 76% is a very big number.
Yeah, incidentally, I'll interrupt by saying I know that you're not looking for applause, but there are many, many emails that were sent to me, and I'd be remiss if I didn't note that many people want to congratulate you on those returns.
Okay, no, I'm not looking for it right now.
I know, yes.
I'm not looking at it, but I'm just saying, we're at 76% from the February lows, and we gave back about 60% of that gain. 60% of that gain. That's the perspective that we should look at. We gave back a little bit more than half, and actually I'm quite disappointed because all along I knew that I was going to give back something, and certainly I know that I'm going to give back when things turn, but I never expected to give back more than maybe a third to 40%. The fact that we gave back 60% makes me very unhappy, extremely unhappy. So there I do sympathize those clients and internally those people who mentioned that perhaps there should have been some kind of deleveraging. Now, it's always a difficult act to do, which is trying to make money, impressing your advantage, and at the same time deleveraging. It's sort of like a oxymoron. But where I think that the mistake so far has been is that for the most part, I tried very hard to play this global event more as a localized event in a more unsystematic fashion. For example, our exposure to India, the Indian equities. India has its own problems. It has little to do at the moment. It's not exactly very much to do with Europe or the United States and with the problems of Europe and the United States. The same thing is true with our short position in Brazil. The same thing is true with our short position in Australia, which is a play on the housing market and the housing boom and the very unbalanced growth that Australia has had and the enormous dependence that Australia has had on China. So, again, where possible, I try to play in an unsystematic fashion this event, knowing fully well that a certain portion of this unsystematic risk will systematic. If things get much better in Europe and the United States, there's going to be a cushion below India and below China that will help, and a cushion below Australia that will help. So I know that, but the question was how much was systematic, how much was unsystematic, how much was unspecific or specific. Where the mistake was is and has been in adding to this unsystematic risk and a small portion of systematic risk, a larger position of systematic risk, a larger amount. And that was, we were, as an example, long tips and bonds, and nominal bonds. And of course, nominal bonds react inversely to markets. And so when markets do well, markets like equity markets do well, they don't do well. So it's a very, very general kind of a play. And the same thing is true with oil and copper, which were very much dependent on global economic activity. So there was too much of a concentration on that part. And it's probably there where I think some of the mistakes were made, and that cost us quite a bit of money in the past few weeks. It would not have saved us from the reactions. I mean, we had some really furious rallies. We assured European banks; they went up 25%, I think, in a period of a week and a half. So it wouldn't have saved us from the overall decline, but it would have made it much better in terms of how much of a correction would we have suffered, and the correction would have been better. The other thing that that I think it's a mistake that we made, and I believe that we can fix that a little bit too, is that we hope that we can fix it, is that we need very hard to look for counter positions to this gloomy outlook. I have a very gloomy outlook. You used the word depression earlier, and I believe that. And I try very hard to look for better situations that would do well either regardless of what's happening or will do well in spite of what's happening. And so far we only really found one, which was the Bank of Ireland, and we'll answer that later, and it's Ireland and the Bank of Ireland. I believe that it probably is in the U.S. market, and the U.S., I don't know if people notice this, but the U.S. stock market has done extremely well compared to the rest of the world. I mean, they're up for the year 2-3%, maybe, I'm not sure, but up a little bit for the year, and while Europe is down 15 or 14 or 18 or 20%, so it's Brazil down for the year 15%, it was down 23%, and India is still down for the year. So the U.S. market is reacting relatively better, and perhaps we should be looking there for better situations, for something that can do well in the next few months, regardless almost of what is coming. I do think that we want to do that, and we are looking to do that, and I think that over the next few months, I'm pretty certain that we will be placing some bets on the long side and on the optimistic, on the sunny side, you know, on the half full glass, in some assets around the world, but that's what we're looking for. Oh, I mean, it's a long-winded answer, but I hope that I answered something.
You did, but I mean, it robs the story of a little drama, but I'm sure that the investors will be hardened. It's the kind of thing that we have done for many, many years in looking to hedge the portfolio in a conceptual way. I think that
that's true. The problem is that things have been so negative across the board that it's been very difficult to find
conceptual hedge.
And, I mean, this is what we want to do because the correlation between assets has been incredible. For the first time in history, we are approaching almost one. Almost every asset acts, it's either minus one or plus one. I mean, it's really quite incredible. But we are looking, and I think we will find. I don't think you can expect it to correlate poorly on a daily basis, but certainly on a weekly or monthly basis, they will.
Let's tidy up some business by speaking about the Bank of Ireland, which is one of those unique, at least in our constellation of investments, uniquely positive bets that you've made. And then finish off, if you could, by speaking a little bit about Canada, about the Canadian dollar in particular, and also about some of the Canadian gold mining companies that you've spoken about buying in lieu of your purchasing, in lieu of your exit from gold, the bullion, the futures.
Okay, let me start quickly with Bank of Ireland. Ireland itself is one of the only one of the five and six countries now in trouble in Europe that has pulled a relatively good adjustment. They did it by way of exports. They did it by way of lowering wages. So the cost structure in Ireland has come down significantly. They have kept low taxes. For international corporations, that's a very attractive proposition. And exports are rising quickly. It's a small country, so even in a pie that's shrinking, they can increase their market share. So Ireland's got all the makings of another success in the next few years. And the best play there, in my view, is the banks, because they will finance that growth. And the best bank right now, the only one that after everything happened, stood in the ground there and didn't fall, is the Bank of Ireland, which went through a very successful private recapitalization. Government, which owned at one point maybe more than 60% of the bank, so its participation dropped to 15. A group in which a prominent Canadian firm was involved took, I think, a 35% interest in the bank, a group of different players. We own approximately 4% in our group. Our funds have a substantial position. And it's a bank that has got a very, very good balance sheet with a very high capital ratio. I think it's 12%. And I think a very high tangible ratio. And very few bad assets. So I think that they're uniquely situated in Europe in an economy that is likely to move up. And we may even do some more purchases in the equity market in Ireland. So that answers Ireland. And now you wanted me to deal
to
with...
To speak a bit about Canada. And also gold mining shares.
Right. Canada is done very well in this last few years, and fiscally they're doing much better than anybody else. It is unfortunate that the government saw a couple of years ago to increase the deficit when they didn't have to. It was simply worthwhile riding the world reflation, the global reflation, is something I pointed out at the time. But they've done well, and at least on a federal level, I'm a little worried about Ontario, which has had an enormous amount of debt and probably worse than California. But at least the federal government is doing well. The Bank of Canada has been okay. So I don't have much negative to say about Canada. I think that Canada is one of those places that will certainly suffer less if there's anything terrible happening in the next few years in economic terms. Now, we did go short the Canadian banks, and the reason we went short Canadian banks is not so much because of their bad portfolio. Their portfolios must be fair. They're probably a lot of real estate, and that Canada had a very large, a very large rise in real estate prices, and I think that that is overdue for a correction. And I think the banks will have some write-offs there. But more because the banking franchise is trading at a big premium in Canada. Banks are trading at 2 to 2.5 times book, when banks around the world, who are admittedly in trouble, but they're big franchises, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and Deutsche Bank and so on, are trading at somewhere between 40 cents on the dollar and 80 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
So the disparity is too great. It was mostly a valuation arbitrage. The fact is that these banks are trading at a little bit too much of a premium. I have to say that we covered some of the position, and we only have half of that, and it was not a very big position, but I think that we probably will make some money on the other half. Now, as far as gold shares, the Golden Record does not have any. The asset allocation fund, which, let me just say something about asset allocation fund, you know, that's a funny thing, it's the hare and the tortoise story. The asset allocation fund is up for the year 12 or 13%, which is about the same amount as the global macro. And yet it has gone up in a very smooth way. I don't know if it's 1% a month, but it's definitely gone up in a very smooth way with almost no volatility. And whereas we have gone under that and over that in very significant fashion in the global macro fund. So there's something to be said about low leverage I'm happy at least that there is a vehicle in the firm that is suited for people with concern about their heart, you know. So,
but in Canada we have Medicare here, though, you know. So
we do, and it's government paid, so great. We don't have to spend any money in it. But the asset allocation fund has, not the global macro, but asset allocation has a position, I think 20 or 25% of the assets of the fund are in gold shares, not in gold bullion now. It used to be gold bullion and gold shares, now it's only gold shares. When we liquidated the gold bullion, we did not liquidate the shares, and that's because we think that the shares are very well priced, generally they're well priced. They're trading at some of the lowest multiples in history. Some of it is justifiable. Simply, institutions today have an alternative. They can buy an ETF, a gold ETF, and they no longer need to buy gold shares for exposure to gold. So the premium has been vanishing almost. And it's likely that they will trade at very close multiples to other base metal producers, and we are on the way there. But given the price of gold and given the price today, and even if it dropped a little bit, it's still a very, very attractive situation. So we think that eventually some value will come out of these gold shares, and that there will be some money, maybe coming from other areas, maybe coming from the oil sector, from the energy sector, of large players with a lot of cash, willing to invest $1, $2, $3, $5 billion and get the gold out of the ground and get some very good returns. Many of these have valuable assets in their books, and they have not been able to exploit it. So it's more like a value play. I would say gold shares are a value play.
Okay. Al, I think we've covered all the territory, and by my watch, in exactly the right amount of time. So I'll just quickly summarize and please correct me if I'm wrong, still decidedly bearish, almost compassionately bearish on the situation in Europe. Fearing a credit compression, you're short a lot of industrial commodities and commodities in general. You are looking to conceptually hedge the portfolio going forward so as to reduce some of the volatility. You do not have gold, any gold bullion. You don't see at the present time a catalyst to warrant your re-entry into gold. You do have gold shares in your asset allocation fund. Have I covered, have I summarized it adequately?
I guess. They only have summarized the aggravation.
The aggravation.
Right.
I think I'll say on behalf of all the investors, better you than us.
All right. Thank you
for your time. Thank you, listeners and investors.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.